All right, so Roots of Renewal is a community development organization here in New Orleans that we started in 2014. We work primarily with formerly incarcerated young men ages 18 to 24 with the goal of offering construction job training and also social services to ensure easy reentry for the guys that we work with. We purchase blighted properties in the Central City neighborhood, and we employ these young men to come and work on it while learning hard skills from our construction crew leaders. And then when the project is finished, it's a four-month training program, and when it's over, we help each of our program participants to identify long-term meaningful work or educational opportunities, and we sell the completed renovated home to a low- to middle-income neighborhood resident that wants to become a homeowner. And I'm the executive director. I'm Amy Fittrell, and Lilith is our opportunities coordinator, which means that she works with our program participants and alumni to find them work and educational opportunities.
Okay, so there's a lot going on, and especially looking at your website, you have a lot of different components. So you talk about incarceration, you talk about the neighborhood of Central City, you talk about housing and rentals. Do you want to talk about a little bit more in depth some of those important keys that relate to the program that you're doing and the people that you work with?
Yeah, so we are really interested in how to create meaningful programs that touch on a lot of the different areas that poverty managed to affect in one's life. And we're looking to work with people who are coming out of prison and jail because they're at a real big crossroads in their life, not only for themselves, but how they interact with the communities that they've left and they're coming back to. And with that, we can't think of reentry in isolation because so many aspects influence one's role in their community and their response to it. So we're looking at how to improve neighborhoods through reducing blight, through increasing home ownership, and therefore increasing stability and creating meaningful relationships across neighbors and neighborhoods. So we really want to see how many different pieces we can put together to combat cyclical oppression and injustice and issues with cyclical solutions.
Talk a little bit too about the importance of programs that address incarceration, especially in New Orleans and especially in Louisiana. How is that issue affecting the people that you work with?
Yeah, so Louisiana is the prison capital of the world. We incarcerate more people per capita here than anywhere else, including China, Afghanistan, Russia. In New Orleans, one in two black men will go to prison or jail at some point in their adult lives, which is exorbitantly high. I did some surveying in the Central City neighborhood with questions about incarceration, and in my small sample, 40% of the households that I spoke to had someone in their household who had been to prison. So this is an issue that's facing a really large proportion of people who live in Louisiana, and particularly New Orleans. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot in the way of reentry programs or things that help people to ease back into society after they've been isolated from it for so long. Our Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office used to have a reentry program, but that doesn't exist anymore. And so basically nonprofits have had to step up and fill the role of helping people to come back into society because it's not something that our government is doing a spectacular job of. And when people come out of prison, frequently they haven't paid rent for however long they've been in prison, so wherever they were living is probably gone. If they had parked in two-hour parking somewhere, their car's been towed, it's impounded somewhere, you know, they certainly don't have a job anymore. There's no income. Frequently they have no food, no ability to really get food because they have no money and nowhere to put it. And there's just this whole list of compounding problems that come along with having been not in society for a long time. And, you know, it's difficult for families to deal with. It's difficult for individuals and especially the young people that we work with who may not even have any kind of track record of employment to fall back on or anything. And so it's really important for people who have the ability to step up and to help to connect some of these individuals to services that are really necessary and help to connect them back into employment and education and all of those things that are landmark steps in people's lives as they grow up. And we really strongly believe that people who have been incarcerated are assets to their community, that they have skills and abilities and that they can come out of prison and jail and they can work and they can improve their communities and they can improve their families and So we really just think it's extremely important to help people capitalize on their own strengths as they come out of prison, and basically just find ways to make themselves and their communities better places.
Yeah, I think that one thing that's important to know in our incarceration cycle is that a lot of the people that are being arrested and going to prison and jail actually have jobs when they are going in, or they're enrolled in some kind of educational program, and that incarceration actually halts everything that they're contributing. They're also family members, parents, children who are helping support their family ecosystem. So we're not just talking about arresting a person and taking them out. We're talking about removing a piece of an ecosystem, whether that's in an immediate family, an extended family within the neighborhood, whether that's an employer or a coworker. So incarceration damages a lot of people in a way that I don't think a lot of people who don't know someone personally realize, but it's one of the most influential things, because there's also an aspect of stigma associated with people who are related to people that are incarceration. You know, where's your parent? Where's your sibling? Oh, they're locked up. And then in certain communities where it's so prevalent, it just becomes an accepted reality of like, oh, blah, blah, blah is back in jail. Blah, blah, blah is not around because he's, you know, up in Angola. And so the way that we normalize the fact that we are picking people up and removing them out of these ecosystems and not saying, well, how can we actually support the people that are already supporting others, but help them, you know, be even more helpful to these ecosystems, and focus on that as opposed to saying, okay, the solution is to remove you, because we see it's not the solution. If you already are facing having to commit crimes, and a lot of it is, you know, to get by or to help pay rent or whatnot, if you remove them and then you give them more debt because of court fees, all of the things Amy just mentioned in terms of having to deal with logistics. Maybe they already struggle with transportation. Now they don't have that car. Now they have to use public transportation to get there. How do you expect them now to be more successful, if not equally successful, than when they went in? So I think just the way we think about what incarceration is needs to be dramatically altered, because it just isn't the right solution.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find that you're able to do that in through Root to Renewal, and what are some, you know, concrete examples?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's unique to what we do, so there are a couple of organizations that work with people that are reentering in the city. Our focus is predominantly young adults, which I think sets us apart from some of the other organizations, in that when you're working with 18 to 24-year-olds, a lot of them haven't served a very long, solid sentence. We know a lot of people up in Angola are getting sent for 10 years. By the time they get out, they're already past our age range. So we work with a lot of people that float in between incarceration in real life, so to speak. And I think what's interesting about what we can do with that is we're not only looking at what reentry is for them, but also just trying to build those foundational steps that weren't maybe there before. And a lot of that, I think, comes from support network and crossing this divide between affluent professional New Orleans and then the areas that we've written off, whether that's people on the West Bank or up in New Orleans East or in pockets of Central City that don't have access to all the resources that we assume that they should, and that's how they're going to solve their problems.
Right.
And so by us being able to insert ourselves at that point, they're still young enough to make dramatic changes in their lives and, you know, to be the parent that they want to be and to be, you know, the career person that they're imagining themselves as, and to kind of backfill a little bit of what has been missed because of structural issues, whether that's education or whether that's work training or housing or any of those things.
Yeah, I think our ultimate goal is just to disrupt the cyclical system as early as we can. A lot of these guys that we've worked with are starting to go in and out and in and out and in and out of prison, primarily because of issues related to poverty. A lot of them struggle to pay for whatever it is they need to pay for to get by, so they rob someone, or they're you know, getting into fights with people because they're stressed out about money. And, you know, there's a lot of connections to poverty, and poverty and violence, as well as poverty and money crimes. That's the more obvious connection. But our goal really is just to kind of break into that cycle as early as we can, because a lot of times with these young people, if you can get a good job early, you know, if you can get someone set up with a union apprenticeship that's 5 years long, that's paid, and when they come out, they're going to be a journeyman, they're going to make $65,000 a year. You know, they're looking at a different pathway that diverges from the way that maybe they've always seen it for themselves and everyone around them. A lot of these guys have only grown up seeing their role models, their dads, their uncles, the people they know in their communities, making money by either selling drugs or robbing stores. And a lot of them don't understand that there are other options and that they can do them. You know, maybe they see like, oh yeah, that white kid that I went to elementary school with, he's going to be a lawyer someday, but I can't do that. And, you know, we hear a lot of that sort of self-defeating language. And the thing is that they can do those things. They're perfectly capable of it. And so when you present an option like, hey, we can help you get into this union apprenticeship, in 5 years, you're going to be making twice what I make. You know, you're going to do great. And when people start to see this as actual open doors, I think it changes the way they perceive themselves, which changes the things they want to be doing in their lives. So that's how you end up with, as Lilith was talking about, people who want to be better fathers and who want to stick around and to work hard and to be a part of their societies, and who don't want that association with the sort of street life that they were in before.
Mm-hmm. And I think one really good example that speaks to that is a young man that we had who spent over 2.5 years up in Angola, the state penitentiary, and he was caught robbing stores. So his crime was armed robbery, but it was originally brought to him as attempted murder. And that tends to be a scare tactic, that they put on these very lofty charges to then try to get you to the plea bargain. So the plea for him was 4 years, and he got out for good time. And when you meet him, he is one of the gentlest souls. You know, you can see him like smiling in the corner kind of to himself because he overheard something nice that someone else said. And once we got him on site, he was just so engaged and so excited about what we were doing. And he really took the carpentry role really seriously. He was our master sawman, so anything you brought it to him, he was measuring, cutting. And he really saw himself there as someone who was quick to pick up a skill, someone who's capable of learning. And one of the most impactful things that he talked about when he came out, or when we were done with the program, was that, one, Roots of Renewal provided him his first experience with being able to trust those around him and learning what it was to trust others. And that was a comment that came up a couple of times, was the brotherhood that was created amongst our crew members, and I think amongst all the people on site, was feeling comfortable and safe with one another. But the other thing that he mentioned a lot of was that he hadn't seen these other options when he was growing up. And so when he spoke about why he got into what he was doing, he talks about this memory of coming home and seeing his mom crying on the couch because she can't pay rent. And so he says, well, I'm already working, you know, my minimum wage job, I'm already helping pay rent, but what happens when that's not enough? And so I think there's this concept that people are choosing to rob because they're too lazy to work a job. The reality is our minimum wage jobs pay $7.25 an hour, and that is really hard to live on when you're supporting, A, just yourself, but, you know, others around you. And so for him, that was the supplemental income needed to support the people around him. And so he was very shocked by his experience. He almost lost his life. And for him, it was a very sobering moment. And coming out, he was just so touched by the opportunity to get to do something different and to see himself as something different and to have other people respect and understand that he could also be something more than what he saw of himself before that. And I think that that was a really, you know, he's a very special person, but I think that's a very normal story as well, that people fall into the roles that they believe that they're worth and that they see that other people believe they're worth. And so through programs like Roots of Renewal and other programs that invest in people who haven't had those opportunities, they start to see that it's not them that's flawed, but it's that they haven't been supported like all the other people who are making it in this world.
Cody, do you feel like you're like a tiny step along path to work that needs to be done. And I don't know if that question makes sense.
It makes sense. Yeah, there's so much work to be done that sometimes it can get really overwhelming, and you look at it and you're like, well, what are we supposed to do with all of the money incentives in the criminal justice system, and what do we need to do about labor laws that will change getting people there? We have to change our whole education system, and we have to, and you know, when you start thinking about how connected all of these things are and how flawed all of these systems are, it can get really overwhelming. And I think that's why collaboration between nonprofits, collaboration between governments and nonprofits and communities is so incredibly important. There's a couple of things we're working on right now that I think make us, we're just a tiny drop in the sea, but sort of connect us to various other groups that are also working on these types of things. One of them is through an organization called the Reconcile Institute, which ties together several small nonprofits so that those smaller nonprofits can have their voices heard more in the sort of competing world of voices out there. And so I've been talking recently with a woman in Rockford, Illinois, who's interested in putting together a very similar program to Roots of Renewal. And so I've had the opportunity to talk to her about kind of what our missteps were along the way and what worked for us and what didn't work, and just sort of give her a little bit of guidance in getting started. And that essentially is a way to start scaling, is to talk to other people who are passionate and interested in the same things in other places. And even if it's not us, even if it doesn't have our name on it, you know, it's still a version of scaling when you can talk to someone and say, hey, this is our model. I'm not afraid to share it. I'm not afraid of competing with you for money or resources. I think that we all need to be doing this work. So here's our model. Here's what we did right and wrong. Run with it. And so that's been a really great thing I've had the ability to do. And then we also have another initiative going on right now called the Poverty Stoplight, which is a multi-dimensional image-based poverty survey. It covers 50 different variables of poverty. And that's something that we're starting a collaboration with several other organizations in the city on, that they'll be able to use this survey to assess essentially what the strengths and deficits are in every household of every client that they work with. And it helps them to sort of set up priorities for how people want to proceed with their life journey and improving their own well-being within their household. And so that's something that is addressing sort of the big nebulous systemic poverty complex on a household level. And we've got several organizations in New Orleans who are starting to do it and interested in continuing to do it. And so that's a way that we, as a collaboration of organizations, are working to attack the whole big ambiguous, nebulous term of poverty. But I think collaboration is just so important because, you know, we're small. We work with up to 6 people at a time. And so, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands that need someone to walk alongside them. So it takes all of us.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a lot that can be learned from, you know, even our testers right now. We've learned a lot along the way. But I think the model that, well, I'm really proud of the model that has come out of this, and I think I can speak for the whole organization, is that we've been really intentional about how each piece fits together. So we're not saying incarceration is an issue, so we're providing services to people coming out. We're also saying, well, neighborhoods need blight reduction in New Orleans because we have a lot of houses that are, you know, decreasing the property values for people that have put their life savings into owning a home. And we know that blighted properties leads to more crime in areas. We also know that people coming out need meaningful work, and they need to be paid for that work so that they're not pushed to commit other crimes when they're really in a pinch. So we're looking at how all these pieces fit together, and it's really coming through the lens of racial and economic inequality. And I think that that's something that's really important, particularly in the lens of incarceration, but really in any major city, because we have a lot of these structures that people almost take for granted or is just natural, but they really have dramatic impacts based on your economic level or your racial background, or a variety of other identity factors. And so how do we make sure that our programs and then hopefully our laws address what those systematic inequalities are? into the conversation a little bit about poverty as a nebula, something that I think is really huge that isn't being really addressed enough in the broader concept of poverty and city poverty, is the post-traumatic stress disorder element of what poverty means in this country. We have criminalized poverty. We have stigmatized poverty from the get-go of this country's founding. So there's that aspect of what people perceive themselves to be within their poverty. But then there's also other elements of, that come along with it, you know, higher rates of violence or of police brutality or of school systems that are more punitive. And then when you're not addressing that people in poverty are also dealing with these elements of PTSD, I think it's very hard to create change. And I think something else that we're really trying to do is confront some of those other aspects by creating a very trusting environment and through partnership of, you know, human-to-human relationship to start to chip away maybe at some of those things that aren't addressed and are just taken as is the way life is, suck it up, get over it.
Mm-hmm. Going back a little bit, something that you mentioned about the poverty stoplight is that notion of almost doing like a needs assessment or kind of checking in with people and seeing what they want or where they can go. What is your process with checking in with the guys that you work with on their goals and where they see themselves?
So that's something that we're still actively developing as an organization. But we use the poverty stoplight with the program participants that we have in our organization. And that's sort of something that Lilith is going to be taking over in the very near future to make sure that we're sitting down with them on a regular basis and saying, okay, how'd your week go? You know, where do you want to go from here? What's your long-term goal? Okay, how do we get there? And sort of starting at the big picture and then backing up and saying, what are the steps to get there? And, you know, I think it's really important to allow people to define their own goals. There's a lot of people that maybe don't want to work in construction, but they need that sort of job training background just to even get into the workplace market at all. And so, you know, last time we had a young man who wanted to start his own daiquiri shop. And, you know, there's plenty of different goals that people come in with. And so just focusing on what it is that they want to do and what are the steps to get them there is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, we did it in much more of an ad hoc manner last time. You know, it was like daily check-ins, and a lot of times it's just reactionary crisis management, which mm-hmm. I think is what we want to step away from and more proactive planning. But I think even just starting the conversation of what are your goals, mm-hmm. what does your timeline look like, are really important. And something, there is some interesting research that was put out pretty recently about how poverty affects people's long-term planning mindset. Particularly, they were looking at around the concept of savings. If you don't ever have savings and you only have what's in your hands, you spend it because you don't have a concept of what it's like to have something in reserve. And so there's very notable differences in terms of long-term planning for people that haven't had the luxury of doing that. And I think that that also really relates to the concept of career planning or educational planning or any of those things. If you are constantly in reactionary mode to the next crisis that's coming up, whether that's being arrested, whether that's someone that you know is being arrested that you are relying on, whether that's the car that you bought for what you could afford is now broken down and you can't get to work, all of those things are in a reactionary mindset. And so I think starting the conversation of, well, what is a proactive way to plan how you're going to use your resources? What does it look like to not buy the cheapest car right now, but to rely on public transportation so you can afford a car that won't cost you as much money over the long term? What does it mean to not take, you know, the first job that comes in the way when you want to be in school right now? So those kinds of conversations are really important, but it's not as simple as just knowing what's available, which is a huge barrier to begin with. So first, it's letting people know what's available. But then it's also internalizing that you can achieve those things. But then it's also really shifting the mindset to what it means to plan something out for a year or for 5 years, or what it means to take time to go to school and have enough money saved up to support yourself doing that. So it's something we really want to develop, and I think it's something that's hugely important. And I think Poverty Stoplight helps with that. Because it gives someone a list of where they feel they're at with all of these areas, but then they get to pick their top five, right? They get to say, oh, these are the five things I want to work on. These are the two steps I can do right now. And it just makes it easier to do. And I think that that's really important to make planning seem accessible and to seem valuable.
Especially, too, it comes in the form of those conversations, but then having it in legitimate and illegitimate fashions.
Yeah. But I think also someone to help hold you accountable to that or someone to help support you through that. So say you made a plan for a year down the road and you're like, oh, well, this got off course because this job didn't work out or I wanted to move here and then move back. But if you have someone saying, well, wasn't this a goal that you wanted to do? Then they can either like, oh, yeah, I do want to be in that track, or, you know, I think my goals have shifted and here's why. And I think the here's why part is really important. So people don't feel trapped, but they know really what it is they're trying to obtain and that they feel like there's support to help get them there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's really important to distinguish the difference between prison and jail. And we touched on that a little bit. But prison is where people go once they've been sentenced, once they've been convicted, particularly for felony crimes. But jail is quite the machine in New Orleans as well. And a lot of times for the young men that we're working with, they're going in and out of jail, but they might not ever see prison itself. But that doesn't mean that jail isn't equally as traumatizing. There's very high violence rates at our Orleans jail. Not only that, it's under federal oversight because of the issues that it's had. And a lot of times how some issues arise with that is that people are arrested. They can't pay their bail for the crime they've committed, so then they end up in jail, and then they're waiting for their trial to happen. Mm-hmm. And then it's a common story that it's so unbearable for the people that are there when it comes time for when they're reaching their consensus. They get offered a plea deal, a plea bargain, to accept, to count the time they served in jail as the crime, as all that they have to serve, and they'll walk away, you know, the next day. So for people that are innocent, that don't want to go through trial because they don't want to stay in jail, sometimes they'll accept that.
Mm-hmm.
For other people, you know, they just kind of get shuffled out of the system, but they've already spent 2 months in jail, and that's before they've even been tried. And so I think that there's a lot of conversation about Angola and the penitentiary and what's happening there, but I think it's also really important to understand how the jail machine works in New Orleans. And what that means for particularly young black men in this city that are shuffled in and out, and that's not even seeing due process of law necessarily yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they're too poor to pay bail.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that that's something that needs to be focused more on within local politics, but also obviously state and federal politics. But I think that's a really big form of injustice that is very classist along with racism.
I think one of the things that most shocked me about doing this work, it has to do with the court fees that have to be paid. You know, in New Orleans, even if you're innocent, you end up paying court fees because you essentially wasted the court's time by being there. So
you wasted
you wasted
they didn't waste yours.
Right. So, you know, there's even people who are coming in through the system who were arrested incorrectly, who didn't actually commit a crime, who came in through the system, and because they had to have a lawyer and they had to go to trial, they then have to pay for that whole process that was unjust to them, which is completely absurd. But we also had, you know, guys who did commit those crimes who came out the other side with just exorbitant court fees, you know, $1,000, $2,000, and for guys who have a criminal record and therefore are unlikely to be able to find jobs quickly that pay them decent amounts of money, being able to make those regular court fee payments every month is extremely difficult and can be prohibitive when it comes to their abilities to reestablish themselves in society for things like savings, opening a bank account, establishing a credit report, all those sort of financial issues that people have to deal with as they're coming back into society. If you're having to make $100 or $200 payments every month on these court fees, it can really throw a wrench in your planning for yourself and your family. And so that was something that I found to be just unreal, honestly.
And the psychological fatigue that comes with that, too, of feeling like everyone's just picking a piece of you so that you don't have enough to sustain yourself.
Yeah, and your sentence isn't over. It's like, you know, you got convicted of this crime. You went to jail or prison. You've mm-hmm. already done your time. But when you come out, it's still hanging over you.
Right.
As long as you have these fees. And for some people, that's years and years and years that conviction is just hanging over them because they have to go to the court every month and make this payment. And so there's this feeling of being still imprisoned by it. And so, you know, that's kind of painful to watch. And I think the system of funding our courts that way is just completely unjust.
Yeah. Especially when you're considering a lot of those, misdemeanors might be marijuana possession. And then you're paying $1,000 for a marijuana possession misdemeanor when people uptown aren't faced with that issue, you know? So that, again, we see where who's getting arrested, who's paying the fees, and the people who are paying the fees are predominantly people who can't afford them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're paying those fees because they're poor and they're easy targets.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that we have good and bad as a binary within our society, what criminal and non-criminal is, yet it's so much more of a gray zone. You know, we construct what is illegal. We pick who gets caught for it, and then we paint people as bad people because of convictions, where we definitely believe people are not their convictions. They're not the worst thing that they've done. And there also can be two people that have done the same exact thing and have dramatically different outcomes
mm-hmm.
based on their privileges and where they grew up or just their luck and timing. And that's something that people who aren't faced with the criminal justice system need to reconcile. That every day that they're not being targeted for the minor legal things, whether that's a U-turn where you're not supposed to, whether that's rolling through the neutral ground, all of those things, if you looked a different way or got paid a different amount, would maybe not give you the same safety to do those things.
Right.
So I want everyone to see themselves as slightly criminal, but also everyone in the world being not completely criminal, so trying to break that down.
So you guys are working with a new group of guys coming up?
Yeah, so we're getting ready to start with our second cohort. We've got a new, terribly run-down house that we're really looking forward to renovating, and we just hired a new crew leader. We're looking really forward to working with him. I think he'll be fantastic and fit really well with the team. And we are looking right now to start right around Mardi Gras, probably wait till Mardi Gras is over to get started.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really excited to start working with a new group.
Well, how can people reach out to you or learn more, or what's the to-do?
We have a website, rootsofrenewal.org. Mm-hmm. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/rootsofrenewal.
Mm-hmm.
We have our email and contact information up on both of those items. We really love for more people to know about us, to get involved, to help support us financially, talent-wise, any other way. We're always looking for people who are interested in working with our participants, whether that's reaching out for possible job opportunities, whether that's, you know, sponsoring their role in our program.
Mm-hmm.
The people in our program do not pay, but, you know, so sponsoring, you know, their wages or whatnot. But
we like to offer as many volunteer opportunities as we can. We do workshops throughout our program where we teach certain things, so resume writing, interview skills, financial management, things like that. So if there's people that are interested in leading one of those workshops, we're always looking for people to do that. We occasionally have volunteer days to do construction-related things. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, if people want to get involved volunteering, there's information about that on the website, or you can always just reach out to us. But we're very open to having volunteers, new donors, people that want to just tell all your friends and family about us. So, you know, just check us out and get involved if you want to.